between what we expect of our companies and our nonprofits. And the talk is simply teeming with compelling if-then statements. For example, after pointing out that we encourage companies to take risks, but frown on nonprofits for doing so, he has this statement. Well, you and I know when you prohibit failure, you kill innovation. If you kill innovation in fundraising, you can't raise more money. If you can't raise more revenue, you can't grow. And if you can't grow, you can't possibly solve large social problems. QED, case proven. If we want our nonprofits to solve large social problems, we must not prohibit them from failure. There's another form of reasoned argument known as reductio ad absurdum that can be devastatingly powerful. It is the process of taking the counterposition to what you're arguing and showing that it leads to a contradiction. If that counterposition is false, your position is strengthened, or even proven if there are no other possible positions that could be taken. Speakers rarely engage in the full, rigorous version of reductio ad absurdum, but they often tap into its spirit by offering a dramatic counterexample and showing it to be self-evidently ridiculous. Here's another snippet from Dan Pallotta's talk. He's arguing that it's crazy how we frown on high salaries for nonprofit leaders. Quote, "You want to make $50 million selling violent video games to kids? Go for it! We'll put you on the cover of Wired magazine. But you want to make $500,000 trying to cure kids of malaria? You're considered a parasite yourself." Rhetorically, that is a home run. Undercutting the credibility of the opposite position is another powerful device, but it needs to be handled with care. It's better used on issues than directly on opponents. I'm fine with, quote, "It's not hard to understand why we've been given a different impression by the media on this for years. You sell newspapers with drama, not boring scientific evidence." But uncomfortable with, quote, "Of course he says that. He's paid to say that." That can drift very quickly from reason to mudslinging. Here's a more attractive way to build a case. At TED, we call it the detective story. Some of the most compelling persuasion talks are structured entirely around this device. You start with the big mystery, then travel the world of ideas in search of possible solutions to it, ruling them out one by one until there's only one viable solution that survives. A simple example is artist Siegfried Wolteck's talk. He wanted to prove that three famous Leonardo da Vinci drawings were actually self-portraits from different stages of his life. To make the case, he framed the talk as his quest to discover the true face of Leonardo da Vinci. He starts with a full palette of the 120 portraits of males that Leonardo is credited with and asks, were any of these self-portraits? How could we know? And then, like a detective eliminating suspects, he starts cutting them down using his own skills as a portrait painter until only three remain. Next, the clincher. Although they depict men of different ages and they were painted at different times, they all share the same facial features, and they match a statue of Da Vinci, the only proven third-party image of him. What makes this persuasive is that we feel as if we have gone on the same learning journey as the speaker. Instead of being told facts, we've been invited to join the process of discovery. Our minds are naturally more engaged. As we eliminate rival theories one by one, we gradually become convinced. We persuade ourselves. This device can be used to turn the most daunting topic into something truly intriguing. A regular challenge for speakers is how to turn difficult subjects like disease or starvation or human degradation into talks that audiences will show up for and engage with. Economist Emily Oster wanted to persuade us that the tools of economics could allow us to think differently about HIV/AIDS, but instead of just presenting an economic argument, she became a detective. She presented a slide titled, "Four Things We Know." Taking each one in turn, she presented some surprising pieces of evidence and effectively demolished them one by one, opening the door for her to present an alternative theory. The power of this structure is that it taps deep into our love of stories. The whole talk feels like a story, better yet, a mystery story. Curiosity builds to more curiosity through to a satisfying conclusion. But at the same time, there's a powerful logic underlying it. If each of these alternatives is false, and there's only one other viable alternative, then that alternative must be true. Case solved. It can sometimes be hard to make reason-based talks really come alive. People aren't computers, and their logic circuits aren't always the ones they engage most easily. To make a talk truly persuasive, it is not enough to build it out of watertight logical steps. Those are necessary, to be sure, but not sufficient. Most people are capable of being convinced by logic, but they aren't always energized by it. And without being energized, they may quickly forget the argument and move on. So the language of reason may have to be bolstered by other tools that make the conclusions not just valid, but meaningful, exciting, desirable. There are lots of tools you can use here, in addition to the intuition pumps mentioned earlier, or the detective story approach. Inject some humor early on. This communicates a useful message. I'm going to pull you through some demanding thinking, but it's going to be fun. We'll sweat together and laugh together. Add an anecdote, maybe one that reveals how you got engaged in this issue. It humanizes you. If people know why you're passionate about the issue, they're more likely to listen to your logic. Offer vivid examples. If I wanted to persuade you that external reality is nothing like you believe it to be, I might first show a slide of a dramatic optical illusion. Just because something looks a certain way doesn't make it so. Recruit third-party validation. Quote, my colleagues at Harvard and I have spent 10 years looking at the data, and we've unanimously concluded it has to be seen this way. Or, and that's why it's not just me arguing this. Every mother of a 2-year-old boy knows this to be true. Statements like these need careful handling, as neither is a valid argument in itself. But depending on the audience, they may make your argument more persuasive. Use powerful visuals. At one point in his talk, Dan Pilotta uses pie charts to show the results of two non-profits' fundraising efforts. First, a bake sale with a 5% overhead, and second, a professional fundraising enterprise with 40% overhead. The second one looks terrible, wasteful, until Dan says, we confuse morality with frugality. We've all been taught that the bake sale with 5% overhead is morally superior to the professional fundraising enterprise with 40% overhead, but we're missing the most important piece of information, which is what is the actual size of these pies? What if the bake sale only netted $71 for charity because it made no investment in its scale, and the professional fundraising enterprise netted $71 million because it did? Now, which pie would we prefer? And which pie do we think people who are hungry would prefer? While he's speaking, the second pie chart expands and the first one shrinks. The non-overhead portion of the second chart is now vastly bigger than that in the first. His point lands with great impact. Dan Pilotta's talk won a huge standing ovation and has been seen more than 3 million times. 3 months after it was posted, the three biggest charity evaluation agencies put out a joint press release that took on board many of his arguments, concluding that the people and communities served by charities don't need low overhead, they need high performance. But not every talk that is reason-based will see such immediate success. These talks are generally harder to process than some others, and they may not be the most popular. However, I believe they are among the most important talks on our site because reason is the best way of building wisdom for the long term. A robust argument, even if it isn't immediately accepted by everyone, will gradually gather new adherents until it becomes unstoppable. Indeed, there's a TED Talk specifically about this, a Socratic dialogue between psychologist Steven Pinker and philosopher Rebecca Neuberg Goldstein, in which she gradually persuades him that reason is the deepest underlying force behind moral progress throughout history. Not empathy, not cultural evolution, although those have played their parts, reason. Sometimes its influence can take centuries to be realized. In the talk, Goldstein shares powerful quotes from history's reasoners on slavery, gender inequality, and gay rights that predate the movements they inspired by more than 100 years. Nonetheless, these arguments were key to the success of those movements. The Pinker-Goldstein dialogue may be the single most important argument contained in any TED Talk, yet, as of 2015, it has fewer than 1 million views. Reason is not a fast-growing weed, but a slow-growing oak tree. Nonetheless, its roots run deep and strong, and once grown, it can transform a landscape forever. I am hungry for many more reason-based talks on TED. In three sentences. Persuasion is the act of replacing someone's worldview with something better. And at its heart is the power of reason, capable of long-term impact. Reason is best accompanied by intuition pumps, detective stories, visuals, or other plausibility-priming devices. 9. Revelation. Take my breath away. Connection, narration, explanation, persuasion, all vital tools. But what's the most direct way of gifting an idea to an audience? I simply show it to them. Many talks are anchored this way. You reveal your work to the audience in a way that delights and inspires. The generic name for this is revelation. In a talk based on revelation, you might show a series of images from a brand new art project and talk through it. Give a demo of a product you've invented. Describe your vision for a self-sustaining city of the future. Show 50 stunning photos from your recent trip through the Amazon jungle. There's an infinite variety of possible revelation talks, and their success depends on what is being revealed. In a talk based on images, your main goal might just be to create a sense of wonder and aesthetic delight. If it's a demo, you're probably seeking to amaze and to create a new sense of possibility. If it's a vision of the future, you want it to be so vivid and compelling that your audience makes it their own. Let's take these three broad categories and dig in deeper. The Wonder Walk. A Wonder Walk is a talk based on the revelation of a succession of images or wonder moments. If a talk is a journey, then a Wonder Walk can be thought of as a studio tour with an artist who gives you revealing insights into each artwork, or a hike in dramatic terrain with a great explorer as your guide. Each step is a simple one from one piece of work to the next, with a sense of wonder building all the while. If you like that, just wait till you see this. Assuming the work is strong, the journey can be enjoyable, informative, or inspiring. This talk structure is most often used by artists, designers, photographers, and architects, although anyone with a body of visual work can use it, including scientists. For example, David Gallo's brief talk on underwater astonishments was a glorious wonder walk, or in this case, a wonder dive. He showed us a series of incredible images and videos of bioluminescent creatures that a science fiction artist could barely imagine. This was followed by astonishing footage of an octopus vanishing from view by changing its skin pattern in an instant to exactly match that of the coral behind it. And Gallo's excitement at the awesomeness of exotic ocean life quickly became infectious. As well as describing what we were seeing, he provided context that had the effect of dialing up the sense of wonder. Quote, "That's the unknown world, and today we've only explored about 3% of what's out there in the ocean. Already we've found the world's highest mountains, the world's deepest valleys, underwater lakes, underwater waterfalls, and in a place where we thought there was no life at all, we find more life and diversity and density than the tropical rainforest, which tells us that we don't know much about this planet at all. There's still 97%, and either that 97% is empty or just full of surprises." It's just a 5-minute talk with a simple structure, but it's been seen more than 12 million times. Another simple but super compelling wonder walk was science writer Mary Roach's talk on orgasm. She walked us through 10 things we never knew about orgasm, including a video of a Dutch farmer with a pig that you perhaps should not watch in the company of either your parents or your children. Wonder walks don't have to be earnest. They can be funny, provocative, and punchy. The appeal of this type of talk from a speaker's point of view is that the structure is clear. You're simply walking the audience through your work or through something you're passionate about one piece at a time. Each piece is accompanied by slides or video and you simply proceed from one to the next, building excitement as you go. But wonder walks work best when there's a clear linking theme. something stronger than just a series of recent examples of your work. Without that, this type of talk can quickly become tedious. Now we'll turn to my next project, is a flat transition line that invites the audience to start shifting in their seats. Much stronger is to give us a link. This next project took that idea and dialed it up by an order of magnitude. And stronger still is to have a through line that pulls all the pieces together. Shay Hembury took us through an exhibition of 100 artists' work. Each piece was completely different. Paintings, sculptures, photographs, videos, and mixed media, covering a vast swath of artistic ideas. The through line? Every artist was him. Yep, Shay had created every single work. Because of that, the more wildly different each new piece was, the more our sense of wonder grew. There are many ways the wonder walk can go wrong, however. Foremost is when the work is described in inaccessible language. Some professions have a ghastly tradition of using needlessly obscure, over-intellectualized language to describe their work, with art and architecture topping the list. When practitioners feel the need to use that same language at a talk, they shouldn't be surprised to see their invited guests quietly slipping out the back door. In this work, I sought to challenge the paradigm of identity versus communality in the context of a postmodernist dialectic. If you're ever tempted to say anything remotely like that, please, please take out your sharpest pair of scissors and slash it out of your script. Steven Pinker pointed out to me that this type of language is much worse than simply the misuse of jargon. Quote, paradigm and dialectic are not technical terms like DNA that specialists can't avoid. They're meta-concepts, concepts about other concepts, rather than concepts about things in the world. Academies, biz-speak, corporate boilerplate, and art critic baffle gab are tedious and incomprehensible because they are filled with meta-concepts like approach, assumption, concept, condition, context, framework, issue, level, model, perspective, process, range, role, strategy, tendency, and variable. There's a valid use for these terms individually, but use them sparingly. When they pile up on each other, you're endangering audience comprehension. Instead, the goal should be to give us the inside scoop. Share with us, in accessible, human language, what you were dreaming of when you started the work. Show us your creative process. How did you get there? What mistakes did you make along the way? When illustrator David McCauley shared his drawings of Rome, he showed not just the finished works, but his mistakes and dead ends, and how he got from there to the published illustrations. That meant that every creative person in the room could learn something from it. Lifting the lid on your process is one of the key gifts of any creative talk. Above all, design the talk to give us maximum experience of the work itself. If your work is visual, consider cutting way back the number of words you use, and instead put the focus on the visuals. A 12-minute talk can comfortably reveal more than 100 images. Perhaps some sequences are allowed just 2 seconds of screen time per slide, and they can be amplified in their power by a tool all too rarely used by speakers. Silence. One of the best examples on TED of a wonder walk is by kinetic sculptor Ruben Margolin. His voice is the whispered backdrop to his astonishing works, the perfect spoken captions to a gallery of pure inspiration. And he has the courage to be silent from time to time. Some of the most powerful moments of the talk come when, having set the context, he lets us simply immerse visually in his work. One clever way to ensure that the walk maintains energy is to make the slides automatically advance. Take a look at Ross Lovegrove's engaging walk through his nature-inspired design projects for a superb example of this. More than 100 slides and videos of his work are revealed in a pre-timed sequence, and Lovegrove simply talks about each as it arrives, the format ensuring a dynamic pace. Louis Schwarzberg did something similar with his talk about his astonishing movie, Mysteries of the Unseen World. He let clips of the movie play through the whole talk while his voice acts as lyrical narration. The result is jaw-dropping impact. Many talks given within companies could be improved if they were thought of as wonder walks. Presentations that plod through your department's recent work, bullet point by bullet point, can quickly get boring. Suppose instead an effort were made to ask, how can we link these projects together to build excitement? How can we communicate what is delightful, unexpected, or humorous about them? How can we switch the tone from, look what we've achieved, to, look how intriguing this is? Suppose instead of a series of bullet points, there was an attempt to pair each step of the walk with an intriguing image. Suppose there was a real effort to figure out what unique and shareable idea you've uncovered that others in the company could benefit from. Ah, now that could be a talk worth shutting down your iPhone for. Whether it's business, science, design, or art, don't just walk people through your work. Figure out the route that engages, intrigues, and enlightens. The route that brings in a little wonder and delight. The dynamic demo. Suppose what you're revealing is not just visual, it's a technology, an invention, or a brand new process. Then it's not enough just to look at it. We need to see it working. We need a demonstration. Great demos can be the most memorable part of any conference. Right there, live on stage, you snatch a little glimpse of the future. When Jeff Hahn showed the potential for multi-touch technology back in 2006, 2 years before the iPhone was launched, you could hear the audience gasp. Pranav Mistry's demo of Sixth Sense technology had similar impact, revealing the amazing possibilities when you combined a cell phone with a personal projector and a camera that can detect your gestures. For example, just framing a distant object with your fingers would take a photo of it that could then be displayed on any nearby white surface. To give such a talk, the single thing that matters most, of course, is the quality of whatever it is you're going to demonstrate. Is it truly a compelling invention or design? Assuming it is, there are numerous ways to unveil it. What you shouldn't do is spend the first half of the talk giving a complicated context to the technology. Your audience hasn't yet seen it in action and may switch off. When you have something amazing to show, allow yourself to indulge in a little showmanship. I don't mean that you should start sounding glib and puffed up, but you should excite us a little. Give us a hint of what we're about to see. Then take us through the necessary context, ideally building toward a powerful climax once the groundwork has been laid. Marcus Fisher is an incredible inventor. At TED Global in Edinburgh in 2011, he showed off an extraordinary robot that looked and flew like a giant seagull. In fact, it was so realistic that when he flew it for us at a picnic after the event, it was poop attacked by a flock of real seagulls, clearly startled by their new competitor. In his talk, he spent the first 10 minutes on the technicalities of flight without really giving a hint at what was to come. He lost some of the audience. The jaw-dropping nature of the demo itself, flying his seagull around the auditorium, soon fixed that. But for the online version, we changed the order of his talk a little so that he opened with the phrase, "It is a dream of mankind to fly like a bird." That immediately gave beautiful context to the talk, helping it soar to millions of online views. Jeff Hahn got it right, starting his talk like this. "I'm really excited to be here today. I'll show you some stuff that's just ready to come out of the lab, literally, and I'm glad that you guys are going to be among the first to see it in person, because I think this is going to really change the way we interact with machines from this point on." In just a few words, he had given intriguing hints that we were to get an exciting peek into the future. Now he was free to go ahead and explain the technology before showing it in action. He gave the background, then he started showing what the technology was capable of, drawing gasps and applause and building amazement all the way. Inventor Michael Pritchard used a similar structure. First, he shared a quick thought experiment on how life would be without safe drinking water. Then he embarked on an explanation of the technology behind the lifesaver bottle he'd designed. Some might have ended the talk there, but the power of the talk was in showing, not telling, and Michael pulled out all the stops. He had a big glass container on stage into which he poured muddy pond water, sewage runoff, and rabbit droppings, turning the water a nasty brown. Then he pumped it through his bottle into an empty glass and offered it to me to drink. Happily, it tasted just fine. And technological theory was turned into theatrical proof. Michael then went on to speak of the implications of his technology for disaster relief and for global public health. Truth was, he'd already won over the audience with the powerful demo of the idea at work. The structure Hahn and Pritchard used is good for most demos. An initial tease, necessary background, context, and or the invention story. The demo itself, the more visual and dramatic the better, so long as you're not faking it. The implications of the technology. Sometimes a demo is stunning enough that it allows an audience to imagine truly exciting applications and implications. And then the demo becomes not just a demo, but a vision of the future. That's where we turn next. The dreamscape. Humans have a skill that, so far as we know, no other species possesses. It is so important a skill that we have multiple words to label its different flavors. Imagination, invention, innovation, design, vision. It is the ability to pattern the world in our minds and then repattern it to create a world that doesn't actually exist, but someday might. Amazingly, we are also able to reveal these non-existent worlds to others in the hope that they too may become excited by them. And occasionally, and even more miraculously, after several people share a vision among themselves, they are able to use it as a blueprint to actually make that world become real. The screenwriter persuades the studio to make the movie. The inventor persuades a company to build the gizmo. The architect persuades the client to fund the building. The entrepreneur energizes a startup team with the belief that they will reshape the future. Dreams can be shared with images, with sketches, with demos, or just with words. Some of the most powerful speeches in history have been powerful precisely because they communicated a dream with irresistible eloquence and passion. Most famously, of course, was Martin Luther King Jr. at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. on August 28, 1963. After carefully preparing the ground and filling his audience with an intense desire to end centuries of injustice, he launched into it. "I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." His speech lasted 17 minutes and 40 seconds, and it changed history. President Kennedy took humankind to the moon by first sharing a dream, and some of the language he chose is surprising. "We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. I realize that this is, in some measure, an act of faith and vision, for we do not know what benefits await us. But if I were to say, my fellow citizens, that we shall send to the moon, 240,000 miles away from the control station in Houston, a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, the length of this football field, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented, capable of standing heat and stresses several times more than have ever been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communications, food and survival on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body, and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere at speeds of over 25,000 miles per hour, causing heat about half that of the temperature of the sun, almost as hot as it is here today, and do all this and do it right and do it first before this decade is out, then we must be bold. But it will be done, and it will be done before the end of this decade." You might think that this framing of the initiative as one fraught with peril and uncertainty would be counterproductive. The reason it works is not just that it makes vivid what is to come. It is that he is making us dream of heroism. He is giving us a trip into the future to read the narrative that will eventually be told about this endeavor. At TED, most of our talks are told in more conversational language. but the ability to paint a compelling picture of the future is truly one of the greatest gifts a speaker can bring. Indeed, Dreamscape speakers have been among TED's most thrilling. They speak not of the world as it is, but as it might be. When these talks are done right, they get an audience's hearts to pound and their minds to explode with a sense of possibility. Salman Khan's vision for an education revolution in which video lessons allow kids to master topics at their own pace was revealed beautifully, piece by piece, and you could feel the excitement in the room building. Filmmaker Chris Milk showed his work using virtual reality to powerfully recreate the experience of life inside a Syrian refugee camp. People worry that virtual reality will shut us off from each other. Milk offered a thrilling counterview that virtual reality devices could become the ultimate empathy-generating machines. Marine biologist Sylvia Earle used powerful images and eloquent language to describe the crisis presented by our overfished, overpolluted oceans. But she didn't stop there. She spoke of what might be if we began creating hope spots, marine protected areas where sea life could recover. Her vision was so compelling that one audience member wrote her a check for $1 million on the spot and is still supporting her work 6 years later. In that time, the amount of protected space in our oceans worldwide has more than tripled. There are two keys to sharing a dream effectively. Paint a bold picture of the alternative future you desire. Do so in such a way that others will also desire that future. Doing both of these in the same talk is challenging. The first part often requires visual aids. Kent Larson spent 18 minutes sharing radical design ideas like folding cars and form-shifting apartments to allow more people to fit into cities without overcrowding. The individual ideas didn't necessarily look like surefire bets, but by revealing them visually, he made them seem much more convincing. Architect Thomas Heatherwick included a slide in his talk that might be the single most appealing slide I've ever seen at TED. It showed a design for an apartment complex in Kuala Lumpur with elegant, curved, high-rise buildings that swelled out from a narrow base to allow space for a gorgeous park at ground level. It painted a picture of a future I would have been thrilled to have been born into. But that's not always the case. Often when technologies are unveiled, the audience doesn't know whether to be excited or to freak out. In 2012, the then head of DARPA, Regina Dugan, revealed a sequence of technologies such as high-speed gliders and hummingbird drones that were both jaw-dropping and somewhat disturbing given their likely military use. And talks about genetic engineering or a computer's ability to recognize faces in a crowd or the development of human-like robots can seem more creepy than appealing. How does a speaker avoid that kind of audience discomfort? The only way is to make it clear why this future is worth pursuing, or present the idea in a way that emphasizes human values, not just clever technology. Bran Ferren attempted this at TED 2014. He spoke of how autonomous vehicles would usher in a dramatically different future, but his talk began with the inspiration he'd had as a child on a visit to the Pantheon in Rome with his parents, and it ended with a call to inspire the children of the future. We need to encourage them to find their own path, even if it's very different from our own. We also need them to understand something that doesn't seem adequately appreciated in our increasingly tech-dependent world, that art and design are not luxuries, nor somehow incompatible with science and engineering. They are in fact essential to what makes us special. What could have been pure tech vision, and perhaps a little scary, ended up human and hopeful. Humor helps too. Juan Enriquez has presented a series of mind-bending talks at TED, showcasing coming developments in biology and genetics that might have seemed deeply alarming if he didn't find a way of injecting a little laughter with every slide. With Juan at your side, the future seems wondrous rather than worrisome. Finally, the more actionable a future vision can be, the better. StoryCorps founder Dave Isay spoke of the power of people asking those close to them deep questions about the meaning of their lives and recording those interviews. He then shared an app that would allow anyone to do this simply and to upload the result to the Library of Congress, creating a permanent record. His vision of a world in which people truly listen to each other was inspiring, and within days of his talk being released, thousands of people recorded meaningful conversations they'd never had before. That's the power of our dreams. They can spread to others, build excitement and belief, and thereby make themselves come true. By giving us a sense of increased possibility, they also inspire us to work harder on our own dreams. If you're invited to go on a journey with an inspired dreamer, that's an invitation you can never refuse. Mix and match. Here's the reality. Most talks do not fit neatly into just one of the categories we've discussed so far. Rather, they include elements from many of them. For example, Amy Cuddy's popular talk on how your body language affects your own confidence is an artful mix of explanation and personal storytelling. And Salman Khan's talk begins with his own story and morphs into a wonder walk through the remarkable features his Khan Academy is building before ending up in dreamscape territory, a thrilling vision of the potential for a new type of education. So I will reemphasize, the above techniques are not to be seen as in any way limiting you. They are tools to help you imagine how you can best undertake your own remarkable construction project in your listeners' minds. Select, mix, match, and augment in the way that works most powerfully and authentically for the idea you wish to build. So, now let's assume you have the through line, the talk content, and have woven together your own artful mix of connection, narration, explanation, persuasion, and revelation. What next? It's time to get this show on the road. We're going to look at four key elements of the talk preparation process that will determine if your talk sings or croaks, whether or not to include visuals, and if so, what visuals, whether to script and memorize your talk or plan to speak in the moment, how to practice both types of talks, and how to open and close for maximum impact. Are you ready? Come along. There's work to be done. Preparation process. 10. Visuals. Those slides hurt. In the 21st century, we have the ability to supplement the spoken word with a dazzling array of technologies that, done right, may take a talk to a whole new level. Photographs, illustrations, elegant typography, graphs, infographics, animation, video, audio, big data simulations, all can dial up both the explanatory power of a talk and its aesthetic appeal. Despite this, the first question to ask yourself is whether you actually need any of it. It's a striking fact that at least a third of TED's most viewed talks make no use of slides whatsoever. How can that be? Surely a talk plus images is always going to be more interesting than just a talk. Well, no, actually. Slides move at least a little bit of attention away from the speaker and onto the screen. If the whole power of a talk is in the personal connection between speaker and audience, slides may actually get in the way of that. Now, it is certainly not the case that there is a zero-sum attention trade-off between screen and speaker. What is being shown on screen often occupies a different mental category than what is being said. Aesthetic versus analytical, for example. Nonetheless, if the core of your talk is intensely personal, or if you have other devices for livening up your talk, like humor or vivid stories, then you may do better to forget the visuals and just focus on speaking personally to the audience. And for every speaker, the following is true. Having no slides at all is better than bad slides. Having said that, the majority of talks do benefit from great slides, and for some talks, the visuals are the absolute difference between success and failure. TED was originally a conference devoted purely to technology, entertainment, and design, and the presence of designers quickly fostered the expectation that slides would be elegant and impactful. Arguably, that tradition is a core reason why TED Talks took off. So, what are the key elements to strong visuals? They fall into three categories: revelation, explanatory power, aesthetic appeal. Let's handle those in turn. Reveal. The most obvious case for visuals is simply to show something that's hard to describe. Presenting the work of most artists and photographers, of course, depends on doing this. An explorer revealing a voyage or a scientist revealing a discovery can also use visuals in this way. Edith Widder was part of the team that first captured the giant squid on video. When she came to TED, her entire talk was built around that moment of revelation. When the incredible creature eventually appeared on screen, the audience nearly jumped out of its skin. But use of images for revelation doesn't have to be as dramatic. The key is to set the context, prime the audience, and then, bam, let the visuals work their magic. Run them full screen with minimal adornment. Explain. A picture is worth 1,000 words, even though it takes words to express that concept. Often, the best explanations happen when words and images work together. Your mind is an integrated system. Much of our world is imagined visually. If you want to really explain something new, often the simplest, most powerful way is to show and tell. But for that to work, there needs to be a compelling fit between what you tell and what you show. Sometimes a speaker will hit the audience with a slide of immense complexity. Perhaps he is unconsciously trying to impress with the sheer scope and nuance of his work. As he continues churning out the words, the audience is desperately scanning the slide, trying to figure out how to match what is being said with what they are looking at. The key to avoiding this is to limit each slide to a single core idea. Some speakers, and especially scientists, seem to have the unconscious operating assumption that they should minimize the number of slides, therefore cramming a ton of data onto each one. This may have been true in days when slides were physical things that you had to load into a slide projector. Today, though, the cost of 10 slides is the same as the cost of one. The only thing that's limited is the time you have to deliver your talk. So, an overly complex slide that might take 2 minutes to explain could be replaced with 3 or 4 simpler slides that you can click through in the same amount of time. TED's Tom Riley speaks about the need to manage cognitive load. Here's Tom.
With a talk in slides, you have 2 streams of cognitive output running in parallel. The speaker needs to blend both streams into a master mix. Talking about theoretical physics has a high cognitive load. So does a slide with dozens of elements. In these circumstances, the audience member's brain has to decide whether to focus on your words, your slides, or both, and it's mostly involuntary. So you must design where attention is going and make sure a high cognitive load on a slide doesn't fight with what you're saying. Similarly, it doesn't make sense to leave a slide on screen once you've finished talking about it. Just go to a blank, black slide, and then the audience will get a vacation from images and pay more attention to your words. Then, when you go back to your slides, they will be ready to go back to work.
If your goal is one key idea per slide, then it makes sense to consider whether anything more can be done with the slide to highlight the point it is trying to make. This is especially true with graphs and charts. If you're talking about how rainfall in February is always greater than in October, and you show a graph of annual rainfall, why not give the audience the gift of highlighting February and October in different colors? And if you then go on to make a comparison between March and November, do that with a separate build or on a separate slide with those months differentiated. Don't leave it all crammed on one slide. David McCandless is a master at turning data into understanding by the use of elegant slides. At TED Global in 2010, for example, he showed 2 slides. The first was titled, Who Has the Biggest Military Budget? It showed 10 squares of different sizes, each square representing a country in proportion to the size of their budgets. The US, of course, was the largest by far. The second slide, however, showed squares representing military budget as a percentage of GDP. And suddenly, the US is in 8th place, behind Myanmar, Jordan, Georgia, and Saudi Arabia. In just 2 slides, your worldview is sharpened dramatically. Other speakers still seem to believe that you enhance the explanatory power of your slides by filling them with words, often the same words that they plan to utter. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Those classic PowerPoint slide decks with a headline followed by multiple bullet points of long phrases are the surest single way to lose an audience's attention altogether. The reason is that the audience reads ahead of the speaker, and by the time the speaker covers a specific point, it feels old hat. When we see speakers come to TED with slide decks like this, we pour them a drink, go and sit them at a computer monitor, and gently ask their permission to delete, delete, delete. Maybe each bullet point becomes its own slide. Many phrases are reduced to a single phrase. They're replaced by an image, or they are deleted altogether. The point is, there is no value in simply repeating in text what you are saying on stage. Conceivably, if you are developing a point over a couple minutes, it may be worth having a word or a phrase on screen to remind people of the topic at hand, but otherwise, words on the screen are fighting your presentation, not enhancing it. Even when a text slide is simple, it may be indirectly stealing your thunder. Instead of a slide that reads, "A black hole is an object so massive that no light can escape from it," you'd do better with one that reads, "How black is a black hole?" Then you'd give the information from that original slide in spoken form. That way, the slide teases the audience's curiosity and makes your words more interesting, not less. When you think about it, it's fairly simple. The main purpose of visuals can't be to communicate words. Your mouth is perfectly good at doing that. It's to share things your mouth can't do so well. Photographs, video, animations, key data. Used this way, the screen can explain in an instant what might take hours otherwise. At TED, our favorite proponent of explanatory visuals is Hans Rosling. Back in 2006, he unveiled an animated graphic sequence that lasted just 48 seconds. But in those 48 seconds, he transformed everyone's mental model of the developing world. And here's the thing. If you haven't seen it, I can't actually explain it to you. To try would take several paragraphs, and even then I wouldn't be close. That's the whole point. It had to be shown on a screen. So next time you're near a computer, Google Hans Rosling, the best stats you've ever seen, watch and marvel. The 48-second clip starts at 4:05. Not everyone can be a Hans Rosling, but everyone can at least ask themselves the question, are visuals key to explaining what I want to say? And if so, how do I best combine them with my words so that they're working powerfully together? Delight. An often overlooked contribution of visuals is their ability to give a talk immense aesthetic appeal. It amazes me that visual artists will often restrict what they show to just a tiny fraction of their work. Yes, concepts in a talk need to be limited, but images? Not so much. The mistake is to assume that you have to explain every image. You don't. If you had invited a prized audience into your own vast exhibition hall to see your work, but you only had time to focus on a single gallery, you would nonetheless first lead them quickly through the rest of the hall, if only to take their breath away and expand their understanding of your broader body of work. With images, a 5-second viewing, even without any accompanying words, can have impact. If it's so easy to offer such a gift to the audience, why withhold it? There are numerous ways to structure a talk that can allow moments of visual indulgence that will significantly increase the audience's sense of delight, even when the topic itself isn't necessarily beautiful. The designer and TED Fellow, Lucy McRae, packed dozens of intriguing, gorgeous images and videos into her talk, all of which generated their own sense of wonder, even when she was talking about body odor. Likewise, the graphic style of a presentation, with elegant font choices, illustrations, and/or custom animations, can make it irresistible. These are some core principles, but with visuals, the devil is in the details. To take us a little deeper, let me invite back to the mic Tom Riley, a man for whom bad visuals are a source of physical pain. Tom, over to you.
Great. Let's start with the tools you'll use. As of 2016, there are three main presentation tools: PowerPoint, Keynote for the Mac, and Prezi. PowerPoint is ubiquitous, though I find Keynote easier to use and with better typography and graphics. Prezi, in which TED was an early investor, offers an alternative mode in which, instead of a linear succession of slides, you move around a two-dimensional landscape, zooming in and out to focus on what matters to you. Most projectors and screens these days are the dimensions of a modern widescreen television, 16 by 9, as opposed to the 4 by 3 of old TVs. Yet presentation software opens up in 4 by 3 mode. You want to immediately change the settings to 16 by 9, unless you're speaking at a venue where they might still only have 4 by 3 projectors. Don't use the software's built-in templates of bullets, letters, and dashes. Your presentation will look the same as everyone else's, and the templates will end up limiting. I recommend you start with a totally blank slide. If you're showing a lot of photos, use black as the background. It will disappear and your photos will pop. Most photographs should be shown full bleed. That's not a horror movie term, but an old printing term, meaning that the image covers the entire screen. Better to have 3 full bleed photos in a row than 3 on one slide. Photos are often still shot at 4:3, so if you wish to show a picture without cropping its top and bottom, put it on a black slide, which will leave unobtrusive black borders on the left and the right. Photo resolution. Use pictures with the highest resolution possible to avoid annoying pixelation of the images when projected on large screens. There is no such thing as too high a resolution unless it slows the software down. It's usually best to use one typeface per presentation. Some typefaces are better suited than others. We usually recommend medium-weight sans-serif fonts like Helvetica or Arial. But don't use excessively thin fonts as they are hard to read, especially on a dark background. If in doubt, keep it simple. Font size. Tiny type causes the audience to struggle. Use 24 points or larger in most cases. Use at most 3 sizes of your chosen typeface per presentation, and there should be a reason for each size. Large sizes for titles and headlines, medium size is for your main ideas, small size is for supporting ideas. Font background. If you're going to place type over a photo, make sure you place it where your audience can read it. If a photo is too busy to put type on directly, add a small black bar at the bottom and put the type on it. Font color. Here, the operative words are simple and contrast. Black on white, a dark color on white, and white or yellow on black all look good because they have great contrast and are easy to read. Use only one color of font per presentation unless you want to show emphasis or surprise. Never use a light color type on a light color background or a dark color type on a dark color background. For example, light blue on yellow or red on black. Just won't be easy to read. Legibility. After you make your font and color choices, look at your presentation on your computer or, way better, on your TV or a projector and stand back 6 to 12 feet. Can you read everything? Do the photos look clear without pixelation? If not, readjust. What not to do? Bullets belong in The Godfather. Avoid them at all costs. Dashes belong at the Olympics, not at the beginning of text. Resist underlining and italics. They're too hard to read. Bold typefaces are okay. Drop shadows can occasionally be useful to improve legibility, especially for type on top of photos, but use the effect sparingly. Don't use multiple type effects in the same line. It just looks terrible. Explanations and diagrams. Use builds. Add words and images to a slide through a series of clicks to focus people's attention on one idea at a time. Give your audience enough time to absorb each step. Don't feed too much of the slide at a time or people will get overwhelmed. Photo credits. In the scientific community, it's especially important to credit each photo on every slide. But it's better to avoid large type, because those citations will draw the audience's eye away from your slide. If all the images are from one source, you can say thanks to National Geographic out loud, or you can add one photo credit that says photos courtesy of National Geographic, and then you don't have to repeat it on every slide. If you do need to include credits, they should be positioned and styled consistently in the same place, same font, same size, no more than 10 points, on every slide. And cut them down from photo credit, colon, Augustin Alvarez, comma, Ames Research Center, comma, NASA, comma, Mountain View, comma, CA, to Augustin Alvarez, NASA. Note that some rights holders, such as museums, may resist abbreviating their credits, but it's worth asking. I usually set credits in white, reversed out of the image, and rotated 90 degrees so they're sitting vertically up the right side of the slide. Ask your friends, are the credits pulling focus away from the images? If so, they're too prominent. Pictures of you and your team. It's great to include a photo of you in your working environment, lab, bush, Large Hadron Collider, but resist including more than one, unless there's a reason. Ben Saunders told us how he journeyed to the North and South Poles. His image is necessary in most photos to tell that story. There was also a whole team of people who worked tirelessly to make Ben's expedition possible, but to show photos of them would have taken the audience's focus away from the main story. While we understand that you want to share the credit, pictures of your team, especially in a yearbook-style compilation of individuals, matter to you, but not to your audience. Resist. And if you must have one photo, make it an organic grouping. It's much better to depict your team in context during a presentation.